Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and we have Jane Gleeson-White making her first appearance at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce her briefly. She's well known to many of you. Jane Gleeson-White has worked as a writer and an editor in Sydney and in London since 1990. She has a Bachelor of Economics, including an accountancy degree and an honours degree in English Literature, both from Sydney University. And she was an intern of the Peggy Guggenheim Museum in Venice. She's the author of two books, in addition to the current book, that is Classics, written in 2005, and Australian Classics, written in 2007, and currently the author of this book, Double Entry, How the Merchants of Venice Shaped the Modern World and How Their Intervention Could Make or Break the Planet. And tonight at the Sydney Institute, Jane Gleeson-White is going to talk on the topic, How Numbers Came to Rule the World. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, for that introduction. And thank you, Anand, so much for having me here at the Sydney Institute. And thank you all for coming. I should thank my uncle, Philip Street, for bringing most of this company, I think. Half of them who are my cousins. And especially, I must thank Nicholas Johnson for recommending me to the Sydney Institute. Although Jared's told me a story that perhaps Nicholas is... So, as Jared said, this evening I'm going to be talking about numbers and how they came to rule the world. So I'm thrilled that there are so many people here that find numbers as interesting as I do. So what exactly do I mean by this, by numbers coming to rule the world? Briefly, the numbers I mean are the statistics that we generate with our national accounts, such as the GDP, and the figures that we generate through our company accounts, such as annual profit figures. These numbers, I contend, now govern the decisions we make at every level of our societies, and increasingly across every sphere of our lives. So powerful is the single GDP figure of the United States of America that a complex ritual has evolved around its announcement, rivaling, it seems to me, in mystique and secrecy, the selection and announcement of a new Catholic Pope. 12 times a year, the chief US statistician, Stephen Langenfeld, and his team lock themselves up in a Washington room without phones and without the internet, draw the curtains, and carry out a task refined over 50 years. They have one goal in mind, to arrive at a single number through the convergence of some 10,000 data streams from recent economic activity in the United States, including harvest, construction, manufacturers' shipments, and retail sales. So powerful is this figure that no one must speak it before its official announcement the next morning at 8:30. Why? Why is this so secret? Because this single number, one number, is capable of rocking the world. In the words of Alan Greenspan, its premature unveiling would roil global financial markets. And so powerful are the numbers generated by the accounts of corporations that they can cast the deciding vote between life and death. A cost-benefit analysis made by the Ford Motor Company in 1977 weighed the relative merits of adding or not adding a safety device to its new Pinto car. This entailed assessing, and I quote, the cost of safety parts versus the cost of lives lost, where the cost of lives lost is the dollar value of men, women, and children potentially killed in unsafe vehicles. Ford's rigorous numerical analysis reached a rather staggering conclusion, but in the terms of the logic of cost-benefit analysis, one that was watertight. But we'll come back to Ford's decision later, because the story of how I became interested in these numbers has nothing to do with numbers at all. And it has everything to do with falling in love at first sight with one of the most beautiful cities in the world, Venice. You can all relax now. Numbers are off the off the agenda for a while. I lived in Venice for 3 years one summer as an intern at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection, where I was inducted into the mysteries and symbolic language of Italian Renaissance painting. And so, warning, numbers returning briefly. And so it was with some astonishment that the following year I heard my accounting lecturer utter the word Venice, a city I would once have considered to be the polar opposite of accounting. Until that moment, I believe the attraction of accounting began and ended with jokes like, why did the accountant cross the road? To bore people on the other side. Excuse me if any of you are accountants. But it seemed it had another attraction, a relationship with my favourite city. From that moment, my lecturer had my full attention. He talked about a landmark treatise on bookkeeping that had been published in Renaissance Venice. This so seized my imagination that I decided then and there to look further into this unlikely affair between Venice and accounting. And I found their relationship went deep. Most importantly, I discovered that what had so closely bonded Venice and accounting in the annals of history was a Franciscan monk called Fra Luca Pacioli. So I then set my sights on this Renaissance monk, who's known today, if he's known at all, as the father of accounting. As I researched, I began to feel that Luca Pacioli's life was the ultimate exemplar of Forrest Gump's life is a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. Except that unlike most boxes of chocolates, Pacioli's life was the metaphorical chocolate box of my dreams. I found everything in it irresistible. It contained Venice, Florence, Milan, art, commerce, religious intrigue, and sexual innuendo. It included the original Renaissance man, Leon Battista Alberti, who was not only an intellectual giant, but an athlete possessed of such physical prowess that he could leap over a horse from a standing position with his legs tied. I should add that's according to him. His life also included the Renaissance artist mathematicians Piero della Francesca and Albrecht Dürer and the new science of perspective painting. It included a communications revolution, magic, lost manuscripts, the game of chess, and, for me, the most irresistible of all, Leonardo da Vinci and mathematics. I am a long-time lover of mathematics, I should confess right now. It turned out that Luca Pacioli was Leonardo da Vinci's teacher. This Franciscan monk taught maths to Leonardo when they were intimately acquainted in Milan in the 1490s, the time when Leonardo was painting his masterpiece, The Last Supper, which required extraordinary mathematical prowess to get the amazing perspective. If any of you have seen it, you know it still lives 500 years later. This little-known monk, whose birth in the 1440s went unrecorded, was one of the most celebrated mathematicians of the Renaissance. In 1494, he published a gigantic encyclopedia in Venice called Summa di Arithmetica Geometria Proportione e Proportionalità, or in English, Everything About Arithmetic, Geometry, Proportion and Proportionality. If it were published today, it would run for 1,500 pages, so it was enormous. As its name and size apply, the Summa contained the entire body of mathematics known to the Mediterranean of the day, which was the recently rediscovered work of the ancient Greeks, which happened after the fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman Turks in 1453. It also included the Latin mathematics of the medieval schoolmen and the advances of the Arabs. And most importantly for my story, it contained Pacioli's 27-page treatise on Venetian double-entry bookkeeping. I found that Pacioli had lived at a watershed in European mathematics, the enormity of which I think is lost to us today because we're so used to its consequences, which is the use of Hindu Arabic numerals, the numbers that we think are just numbers without really thinking about it. And it is here that the story of the rise of numbers really begins. In the 15th century, Italian mathematics absorbed two significant new elements, Hindu Arabic arithmetic and ancient Greek mathematics. Thanks to Luca Pacioli's rare combination of talents and training, the same century also saw the merging of two streams of mathematics which had been separated since the 6th century BC, the philosophical mathematics of Pythagoras, which was based on geometry, and the commercial arithmetic used by merchants. According to the Greek historian Herodotus, geometry originated in Egypt and was associated with the land surveying required for the regular flooding of the Nile. I won't make jokes about the floods out west in that context because it's way too serious. I wasn't going to make a joke, don't worry. That's my mother. Hence, geometry, from the Greek for earth and measure. Commercial arithmetic was developed by the Phoenicians, who were the great merchants of the ancient Mediterranean. And ironically, it was the son of a Phoenician, Pythagoras, who lifted the geometry, the metaphysical side of mathematics, and separated it from the commercial. And those two streams of mathematics remained separated for the next, until the 15th century. So from Pythagoras onwards, maths was split into two broad streams: the arithmetics used by merchants in their daily business transactions, and the numbers used by philosophers to express the secret harmonies of the universe. After the fall of Rome and the rise of the Christian Church, maths languished in medieval Europe. Its development was held back by the Church, whose view of it is best expressed in this comment attributed to Augustine. I might have a quick drink of water. Excuse me. Thank you. Who said, "The good Christian should be aware of mathematics and all those who make empty prophecies. The danger already exists that mathematicians have made a covenant with the devil to darken the spirit and confine man to the bonds of hell." But during the same period, maths blossomed in the Arab world. By 1200, the Arabs were the most sophisticated mathematicians of the Mediterranean. Having developed the mathematics of India, their numerals and their algebra and their arithmetic, hence the name Hindu Arabic numerals. This new maths from the East was introduced to Europe through Muslim Spain, but the first real breakthrough in its use came with Leonardo da Pisa, who's famous today as Fibonacci. I'm sure you've all heard that name. Leonardo da Pisa grew up in Africa in an Italian town and learnt the maths of the Arabs in the merchants in the bazaars, the local bazaars. When he returned to Italy, he wrote an influential work on Arabic mathematics called Liber Abaci, which appeared in 1202. Fibonacci's maths was, of course, rejected by the Church. For example, when the English philosopher Francis Bacon attempted to promote it, he was charged with magic and condemned to life imprisonment. This is for using the numbers that we use today. But it found a ready audience among the merchants of Italy, where it became known as Maths Abaco Mathematics. This new Abaco maths made possible what we now take for granted: the adding, subtracting, multiplying and dividing of Hindu Arabic numerals on paper with a pen or pencil. But, you know, how long we'll be able to do that for is also up for grabs now. This system was inscrutable to most Europeans at the time, who used counters on a board to calculate a sum and then recorded the details, the answers, in Roman numerals. Still in the 15th century, they were using Roman numerals, which left no written trace of the calculation made. An alternate vernacular education system based on Fibonacci developed alongside the Latin-based monastery schools of Italy, known as Abaco schools. They taught Hindu Arabic maths and the rules for solving common commercial problems to the sons of merchants and artisans. So while this Abaco maths was transforming the way that generations of Italian merchants and artisans understood the mechanics of commerce and the material world, in the rarefied university of European universities, mathematical techniques were regarded mostly as fictions, not considered to be a language for use in daily life. Almost uniquely in Italy, Luca Pacioli was fluent in both Abaco and university mathematics, which perfectly equipped him to seek his fortune in Venice, which was then the financial and commercial centre of the world. Pacioli travelled to Venice aged 19 to work as an Abaco teacher for the sons of a Venetian fur merchant, and it was there that he learnt bookkeeping Venetian style and studied university mathematics at the famous Rialto School. At the age of 49, after 3 decades travelling through Italy teaching mathematics, Luca Pacioli put his rare mathematical knowledge to good use. He returned to Venice, which was by then the centre of the book printing world, to publish the culmination of his life's work so far, which was his great encyclopedia, the Summa. Pacioli's encyclopedia united the two streams of mathematics which had been separated since Pythagoras' day, and the mix would prove epoch-changing. It spurred the gradual rise of maths to its eventual replacement of Latin as the lingua franca of Europe and ushered in a new age, the age of science. The Summa made 2 immense contributions to the scientific and commercial life of Europe. It was the first printed book to deal with Hindu-Arabic arithmetic and its offshoot, algebra, and it contained the first printed treatise on Venetian bookkeeping. It thus bequeathed to Europe the 2 tools that rule the modern world, Hindu-Arabic numbers and double-entry bookkeeping. Pacioli became famous in his day for his knowledge of mathematics and his passion for disseminating its secrets via the printing press. But his lasting fame would rest on his 27-page bookkeeping treatise, which was called, quite, you know, uninspiringly, Particulars of Reckonings and Writings. As with Hindu-Arabic maths, the Venetian bookkeeping system that Pacioli codified is so natural to our modern way of thinking in debits and credits that we take it for granted. But in 1494, it was exceptional, and in his treatise, Pacioli recommended it above all other forms of bookkeeping. In their system, Venetian merchants separated debits and credits in their ledgers, and that was their great innovation. As Pacioli says in his treatise, this is the most important thing to note in Venetian bookkeeping. He says, all the creditors must appear in the ledger at the right-hand side, and all the debtors at the left. All entries made in the ledger have to be double entries. That is, if you make one creditor, you must make someone debtor. Pacioli also makes clear that the purpose of every business was to make a lawful and reasonable profit, which can be calculated with Venetian bookkeeping. So, Pacioli was the first to codify Venetian bookkeeping, and because he used the printing press to record and disseminate this important commercial information, it was his version of Italian bookkeeping that spread across Europe during the next 2 centuries, through Germany to Holland, England, and then to America. By the 18th century, double-entry bookkeeping had become so pervasive that it had spread beyond the realm of business and commerce and into European culture more generally, which is evident in the literature of the time. Daniel Defoe famously applied it in his novel Robinson Crusoe, published in 1719, when the shipwrecked Crusoe uses double entry to assess his life, drawing up his state of affairs and stating, and I quote, very impartially, like debtor and creditor, the comforts I'd enjoyed against the miseries I'd suffered. Goethe also refers to double-entry bookkeeping in his novel Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, when the character Werner extols the spirit of a genuine merchant and asks, what advantages does he derive from the system of bookkeeping by double-entry? It is among the finest inventions of the human mind. Thank you, Goethe. Goethe was writing in the 1790s, a time when Europe was undergoing massive transformation. Italian bookkeeping would be swept up in the energy of the new industrial age and be likewise transformed. With the flourishing of a new form of business organisation called the Joint Stock Company, bookkeeping morphed into a brand new profession, accounting. The financing and management of the vast investments required to build railways during the 19th century brought new issues of accountability. Most other successful industries of the time, pottery, cotton, wool, and iron, had started small and grown through the reinvestment of their own profits. Such a system with railways was impossible. Huge amounts of capital expenditure were required at the outset, and they were raised not through profits, but from private investors on stock exchanges and managed by joint stock companies. Hence our modern system of stock exchanges and corporations. Repeated cases of fraud and corporate failure, nothing changes, put pressure on the British government to protect creditors and investors on the new stock exchanges. The British Parliament eventually forced companies to keep publicly available financial statements based on reliable accounting records, starting with the Joint Companies Act of 1844. By the 1860s, accountants were required at every stage of a company's life, at its formation, during its operation, and at its liquidation. Needless to say, the number of accountants increased accordingly. In 1811, there were 24 accounting firms listed in the London directories. By 1883, there were 840. So, at the beginning of the 19th century, financial statements were an incidental product of an enterprise's bookkeeping system. By 1900, they had become its raison d'etre. And Venetian bookkeeping proved to be the perfect mechanism for generating these financial statements. Luca Pacioli's double entry, with its Hindu-Arabic numerals, could accurately record capital and income as required by law and investors. It could distinguish between private expenses and corporate costs, and it could produce data that helped to evaluate past investment decisions. By 1900, most businesses across the planet were keeping their books in Pacioli's double entry, which is extraordinary. And so double entry bookkeeping and the numbers it generates became essential to the workings of the modern corporation. In the 20th century, they became equally essential to the machinery of the modern nation. With the crash of the New York Stock Exchange in 1929, the laissez-faire principles that had previously guided, or not guided, government approaches to national economic affairs suddenly lost their luster. Over the next 4 years in the United States, 11,000 banks failed. Production collapsed by more than a half, and unemployment rose to nearly half the workforce. To guide their policy responses to the crisis, the administrations of Herbert Hoover and Franklin D. Roosevelt commissioned Russian-born economist Simon Kuznets to develop comprehensive estimates of the income of the United States. In 1934, the British economist John Maynard Keynes went to America to see Roosevelt's New Deal in Washington in action. In Washington, he said, "Here, not in Moscow, is the economic laboratory of the world." This signified a momentous change in both government practice and economic theory, prompted by the Depression. If Roosevelt's response to the Depression was the New Deal, which was the first full-scale, systematic government intervention in a capitalist market economy, then Keynes's was his theory of effective demand, which provided a theoretical basis for the measurement of national income, consumption, investment, and savings. Both Roosevelt's program and Keynes's theory entailed the construction of national accounting systems, a massive undertaking that was carried out using the principles of double entry bookkeeping. The first American national accounts were made during the Depression, the first British accounts during the Second World War. But Keynes was suspicious of statistics and considered these quantitative expressions of the national economy to be temporary, emergency measures demanded by the time. The British Chancellor expressed the same view, stressing that they are an exceptional measure made necessary by war. But instead, as we know, these national accounts became an annual event in the United States and Britain. And following the war, national accounts were constructed in countries across Europe as part of the framework of the Marshall Plan. And then under the aegis of the newly created United Nations, standardized forms of national accounts were compiled and have, since the 1950s, been implemented in most nations on Earth. GDP measures are now used by governments to calculate budgets and assess the impact of fiscal and monetary policy on an economy. They are used by politicians in campaign strategies and by corporations for investment decisions and Wall Street takeovers. And they have a profound influence on markets, as we saw with the secrecy surrounding the announcement of the American GDP figures. The GDP, this one miraculous figure, apparently, and I quote from the Bureau of Statistics, compresses the immensity of a national economy into a single data point of surpassing density. And governments and many people believe that only this one statistic can really show whether things are getting better or getting worse. But the GDP was not designed for this purpose. It was not conceived to be the primary gauge of the economic health of a nation. It was not created to be a key tool for policymakers and investors. It was not born to govern global financial markets. As a measure of national well-being, the GDP is a deeply flawed rule. Simon Kuznets himself warned of the limitations of GDP measures, especially their exclusion of household production and other non-market activity, as well as their failure to count the many costs of economic development, which I think we're all feeling in the 21st century. Kuznets' concerns have been reiterated ever since, most famously by Robert Kennedy in a speech he gave in 1968, just months before his assassination. Just have to check the time.
How are you doing?
Doing fine. So here's Kennedy on the GDP accounts of the United States. Here's Kennedy on the GDP accounts of the United States. He said, "Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year, but that gross national product, if we judge the United States by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising, and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwood and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm and counts nuclear warheads and armoured cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifle and Speck's knife and the television programmes which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, certainly not, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile." But it's not just the numbers generated by national accounts which are flawed. They've also proven fallible in the case of corporate accounts, most spectacularly in the case of Enron, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, but more recently and closer to home in the demise of ABC Learning. There, two sets of auditors found two completely opposing stories in the company accounts. One of impending disaster, which we know turned out to be the correct one. The other of a viable business. But the third party brought in to arbitrate could fault neither of the radically different conclusions. So, Luca Pacioli's double entry has morphed into an exacting global calculus and created a culture that makes possible reasoning which generates ruthless decisions such as the one made by the Ford Motor Company in 1977. Which brings us back to its Pinto dilemma. So, what did the Ford Motor Company decide? An internal company memorandum estimated that, and I quote, if the Pinto was sold without the $11 safety feature, 2,100 cars would burn every year, 180 people would be hurt but survive, and another 180 would burn to death. The calculus revealed that the money saved by a safer car would be $49.5 million, but the cost would be $137.5 million. Clearly, the costs of the safety device far exceed its benefits in numerical terms. And so naturally, Ford decided not to spend money on the safety feature based on the inexorable logic of these two simple numerical equations. According to the journalist who wrote the story, Mark Dowie, in the 6 years from the introduction of the Pinto to 1977, when his analysis of the case was published, at least 500 people burned to death in Pinto crashes. And so I ask you, do you believe the numbers denominated in money that we've allowed to rule our lives are really our best possible arbiters? These same numbers that tell us to risk people dying rather than installing a safety device on a car, that tell us to cut down a forest of redwood rather than leaving it alive. I leave you with John Maynard Keynes, who made a quite radical remark in 1933. He was in Ireland, so perhaps the whiskey or leprechauns had loosened his tongue, but in that year he spoke the following truth. Once we allow ourselves to be disobedient to the test of an accountant's profit, we have begun to change our civilization. So, Merchants of Venice, I can give you. Gnomes of Zurich, who were mentioned in the publicity for this talk, I'm sorry, I cannot give you. But I hope the Monk of San Sepulcro will do in their place. It is he and the Merchants of Venice who have given us the tools that I argue rule the modern world. Thank you very much.
So many thanks to Jane Gleason-White. Thanks also to Nick Johnson, our chairman, who told us about Jane, and that's why she's here tonight. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Double Entry. This is the paperback version of the hardback that was out last year. The paperback, I think, has just been released, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of that. And so we come to question and discussion, and I should say, talking about fraudulent numbers, I think it's not exactly true that everyone in the room is related to Philip Street. You can get to that conclusion by significant amounts of multiplication, I think. So. But just you almost ended up with Bobby Kennedy, but I think he made that comment in 1968. He had been a pretty hard man in the JFK administration. He hadn't shown those tendencies then. And if he'd actually won the Democratic nomination and went on to become president in 1969, which was a possibility, nothing much would have changed, would it? I mean, the US would have still measured things the way they measure things because there's not much other way to measure it. So how seriously should we take Bobby Kennedy sounding off on these kind of matters? Being ruled by numbers when he had an opportunity to rule, he ruled by numbers, if anyone rules by numbers. So just talk down to the back of the room like you were talking before.
Thank you for that provocative question, Jared. Well, actually, I mean, I think Bobby Kennedy was a lot more radical than he was ever given the chance to be. So I can't say what he would have done in government, but I can say that his exhortations in 1968 have been taken very seriously by a number of American congressmen, and that from about the beginning of the 20th, 21st century, there's been a group of congressmen appealing to the United States government appealing to Congress to change the way that these accounts are measured. And when Obama introduced his healthcare legislation in 2010, I think, there's one small clause in that massive, massive piece of legislation that pertains to the introduction of new forms of measuring the success of the American nation, which do not depend on GDP and the accounts denominated in money that we're so familiar with for the last 50 years. So actually moves are being made, and not only in America, but in France. Nicolas Sarkozy has found it impossible to govern with the demands of economic growth and his electorate's need for want of a better word, environmental protection. So he's also been talking about it and has commissioned three economists to look into the possibility of providing national accounts which account for more than just the commercial activity that Bobby Kennedy outlined in his speech. And also in the UK, 100 economists have called for the British government to do the same thing. So actually, maybe things are changing.
There's a question over there. We've got plenty of time. You stay where you are. Yeah.
As you're talking and as we watch the world, a lot of what's happening in terms of what money is or what credit is or what a country's value is all really a lot of funny money. I mean, one day Greece is about to go through the black hole, and one day there's a decision that they'll give it more credit. I mean, to what extent are we all just living on borrowed time and credit? Because at some point, real money has to be imported, not just airy fairy notions of what a country's worth.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, fantastic question.
I mean, money, the figures have to be real eventually.
As Enron found. You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's all, as you say, funny money, is that what you said? And dodgy accounting. You know, who knows? I was amazed that we could get to 2008 without something faltering. So it is quite extraordinary. I honestly think it's sort of an act of faith, and it is, you know, not to be too extreme, the religion of the contemporary world. And if we believe in these numbers, somehow, you know, they seem to work as if they were real. But yes, ultimately, there has to be, time has to be called. I don't know how, you know, when or how or whatever time will be called, but all I know is, we all know now, these accounts are fallible, and that we give them, you know, we attribute them such enormous power. So we human beings, I think we need to find a whole other way, but that will require different ways of valuing, you know, our lives, I think. It probably hasn't really answered your question. It's hard to
quantify.
We've got plenty of time. Yes.
What is your view in the academic sense relating to imaginary numbers defined by the square root of minus one? Have you fed that into your thinking?
I fed that into my thinking a lot when I was studying mathematics, but thankfully irrational numbers don't come into... Well, they do come into Luca Pacioli's encyclopedia, but they don't come... And I don't think he knew what to do with them either.
Yeah.
So I'm with Luca Pacioli.
That's your short answer.
Yeah. Well, I was, you know, when people heard that I was writing a book about mathematics, they seemed to think that it implied some, you know, extraordinary mathematical prowess. And although I did do mathematics at university, I certainly don't have extraordinary mathematical prowess. What I didn't tell them was that the mathematics I was dealing with was simple arithmetic, that we all know today, but which in the Renaissance was revolutionary. In Europe, anyway.
Yes, question.
Yes. I always learned at school that it was the monks going off in Constantinople that started the Renaissance in Italy. Now, in the north of Italy, you have the Lombard bankers, and whilst their fact that they got rid of the church's embargo on interest, which the Jews didn't have and the Arabs didn't have, I don't know about the Arabs, get it. But it was that was so important, or was it what you were saying about bookkeeping, or that getting rid of interest plus bookkeeping that gets capitalism going in Europe?
Fascinating question. I've left out that whole... That's sort of in my book, but I had to leave out that whole is not the sideline, is actually almost the crux of my book. But yes,
the question. The question
is about.
It's about the abolition of interest. Right?
Yeah, the question is about the abolition of interest and the other developments in banking in Northern Italy at the same time as double entry bookkeeping was emerging. And you're absolutely right; they go hand in hand. And you know, so there was during the Crusades there was an economic boom in Northern Italy from about the 11th century. And all these cities, these city-states, developed extraordinarily... Well, they became incredibly wealthy and developed sophisticated banking systems. And as you so rightly say, more or less, by not only using Jewish moneylenders, avoided the church's ban on usury, because there were various sorts of ways that the Christian banker could avoid the charge of usury by, for example, making investments so risky that they weren't deemed to be usury, even though they attracted a profit. So, not a profit, an interest rate. So there were all sorts of ways around it. But yes, so an extraordinary sort of commercial transformation happened in Northern Italy from about the 13th century, and that's also when the first double entry accounts come, the rise of banking in Florence especially, and then in Venice, and the use of Hindu Arabic numerals, which came later. And so that was the centre of this incredible economic boom, and I argue in my book that is where capitalism started. You're absolutely right. You learned that at school, did you? I'm interested. I think you worked out the right thing. That's what I've kind of worked out as well. And it's fascinating, and we're not the only people to think that. Luckily, I found a few scholars who supported my view, but yeah, it's a very interesting period.
Question here.
In your book, which I found absolutely riveting,
thank you.
You have a nice little story about the cost of a hamburger. And
I'm wondering
if you could just repeat that story for people and also touch on the implications of that amount that's referred to.
Thank you very much for asking that question and taxing my memory. But it is the most fantastic... gimmick. It's not really a gimmick, but it is a truthful analysis by an American economist who I greatly admire, who worked for the World Bank, so he's very serious economist. And he said that the Big Mac should not just be $1.60. I actually have no idea how much they are. I don't buy them, but they shouldn't be that price. They should, if we costed in every single thing that a Big Mac, every cost of making a Big Mac, it would come to $200. So he calls it the $200 hamburger, because not only does it just take the wheat and flour and meat and whatever that is in the actual hamburger, it causes obesity, and so there are healthcare costs that it exacts, and then it. I have to think, so there's the environmental damage that's done by the tomato growers in the southern states of America that have taken over. I might have to refer to my book to give you the details, because it is fascinating, and I'll have to get Raj Patel's telling, which I'll find immediately at the end of this chapter. Excuse me, Raj Patel. It's right at the end.
Make it up.
No, because there are very interesting details. Like, I failed to make it up, and now I'm. Thank you.
Try 222.
Thank you very much, Jared. I now have it. I'm pleased that you can. I'm pleased you can use
page numbers.
You're using my book more efficiently than I am. What does that say? I don't know. But his $200 hamburger is on the next page. Okay, so... Oh, no.
Are you on the same page?
Yeah, yeah. So the reason Big Macs sell for almost a hundredth of the figure of $200 American is that their drive-through price does not account for their real costs. These include their carbon footprint, their impact on the environment in terms of water use and soil degradation, and the enormous health cost of diabetes and diet-related illnesses and heart disease. Traditional accounting models do not take these costs into account, but they still have to be paid. It's just that the McDonald's Corporation does not pay them. So who does pay them? We do. Society as a whole pays in the form of environmental disasters, climate change-related migration, and higher health costs. And I guess this is a contentious way of looking at things in the views of some people, but I think it's a very reasonable way to look at it. So I like what Raj Patel goes on to say, which is that while the $200 hamburger is an estimate, what is abundantly clear is that the market fails to account for all the actual costs in the price we pay at the checkout. As Patel sees it, the fact that corporations are not paying the environmental and social costs they rack up amounts to a corporate subsidy on a massive scale. You'd be forgiven for thinking that this ongoing bailout from nature and society to private enterprise is what puts the free in free markets. So I just had to get to that point. Very good. So that's free market economics for you, where corporations don't pay the cost.
It also depends how many of those hamburgers we're going to have.
Yeah. I mean, it's a contentious idea, and he does it to illustrate a point. But I think it's a good point, and you would obviously dispute that.
Product is only worth what someone will pay for it.
Well, you see, I mean, that's a very interesting statement as well.
Yeah.
It is, but so it's only worth what someone will pay for it, but
that's
doesn't mean that's what it costs.
$200.
Yeah. And wouldn't that be good?
The Sydney Institute, we're very much into sell it and holy water, so you're in good company. I think we've got a bit of disruption, and mainly from the deputy director. So I think we've got here we go. Yeah.
The more serious business of accounting. I believe the Quran forbids the taking of interest. And how do Islamic banks or banks in Islamic countries get around that problem?
It's a question about the Quran forbidding the taking of interest. Yeah.
And I don't know very much about Islamic accounting, but interestingly enough, I mean, I know today they have very different practices from ours, and that seems to have saved some of them from the excesses of the West in recent years. But I do know that in the early Islamic State, say from about the 7th century, Islamic accounting was, or Islamic accountants used a system very similar to Venetian double entry bookkeeping, and many of the historians argue that that's where Italian double entry bookkeeping came from. So very possibly, although today, as you say, the Quran, does it forbid taking interest? Yes, thank you. And I know that they have very different financial systems to ours. In the strictly Islamic nations, but possibly Islam was the origin of our modern accounting system. So, you know, one more irony in the many ironies of this strange story.
Just a serious question on that, because if you look through that period of history, the Catholic societies didn't do very well in Southern Europe economically. They didn't do well. The Muslim societies in that period didn't do well. And the societies that did do well were the Protestant Calvinist society that had high interest rates. So, in other words, Northern Europe thrived, Southern Europe was poor, and North Africa was also very poor. So someone who thought up the interest rate concept probably had a pretty good idea, didn't they?
But the Northern Italians were the wealthiest during the period where my story takes place. And it was only afterwards that the Germans and the Dutch and the English caught on. And interestingly enough, it was only Henry VIII who first outlawed the ban on usury. Yeah, in Northern Europe. And that was part of it. Yeah, outlawed the ban. So Henry VIII made charging interest, you know, usury, legal. And that was part of his overturning of Catholic Europe.
Hang on,
There's also a correlation.
Hang on, just a second. Yes, just speak up. Yep.
There's also a correlation not only with the interest rate, but with the rate of working, the northern people just worked hard, and that plays a huge role compared to whether there's an interest rate.
The suggestion is that the northern Europeans worked harder than the southern Europeans.
This could be outside the scope of my book. But it is certainly the hard-working northern Europeans could be outside the scope of my book. But it's certainly proving to be the case today. But I mean that doesn't. Central to the argument that northern Europe became wealthy after the Italians faltered.
And the argument is that usury, lending money and getting something for lending money, grows business, and that's why capitalism is a worthwhile thing. And capitalism brought the wealth, not how hard people work, but using your money.
Well, the Venetian merchants and the merchants of Italy worked very, very hard until their sea route monopoly, until their monopoly to the east was broken with the discovery of the sea route to the east. So there are many, many factors. So, yes.
Wait a second. More or less, we all started with no money, no real assets. Whether there's usury or not makes no difference to whether you're going to grow the assets. Whether people are going to work and manufacture things and develop the assets, that's really the centre of it.
Yes.
If anyone wants a loan, I go to her.
And
if you work hard, yes,
I'll pay you. Going to get it for nothing.
And in Italy, in the 13th, 14th, and 15th century, the Italians were working really hard.
The revolution, the American Revolution, which goes back to knowledge, not money.
Okay, the suggestion we're forgetting the Industrial Revolution. But I think Penelope Nelson, just hang on. Penelope,
just
speak up a bit.
Two local Pintos while you were speaking. One is whether we can afford to stop having unflued gas heaters in primary schools, and whether there's a better solution than just delay for the cost. And the other is the cost of sprinklers in nursing homes, both very acute and very expensive challenges in New South Wales right now.
Absolutely. There are instances of that everywhere. I mean, the cost of education at Sydney University is also, you know, up for grabs at the moment, or education as a commodity at Sydney University. I don't know if you're related to that. But I mean, these sorts of cost-benefit decisions are happening in our hospitals, in our schools, in our universities, in places really where they shouldn't be the deciding factor. But we've sort of bound ourselves into this system, and I don't know how we're going to get out of it, this, you know, financial system.
We're getting close to the end. There's someone down the back. Yes.
I suppose I want to draw on your Guggenheim experience. The problem with accounting, and we think it's a science when in reality it's an art.
Beautifully put. If only we all knew that, then, you know, I don't think we would trust these figures so much. I completely agree. Except that the problem with economists and accountants, excuse all the exceptions who are here tonight, is that they've tried to turn their social sciences into sciences with the sort of logical rigour of a science, and you're absolutely right, they are arts, and they're approximate, and they're arbitrary. And, you know, that's really all I'm arguing, but I don't think many people know that, and I also don't think we behave as if that's the case. I think we behave as if these numbers are infallible. Hence, you know, the great ritual around the announcement of the GDP in the United States, because it really does rock the world.
So that goes back to your earlier point. Why did the accountant cross the road? The answer is the sellies are.
And now that I've finished boring all of you on the other side of the
Now, I'm just going to ask, unless I'm missing, I'm just going to ask the last question. Your earlier books were on literature. You have now moved into accountancy with a flash of history and a lot of argument. You're now a full-time writer, so why did you write this book, and what are you likely to do next?
I wrote that book because, as I said, I just became so fascinated by the connection between Venice and accounting, which seemed to me so unlikely, and now I know, of course, that they go hand in hand in history. And I I've found the life of Luca Pacioli so absolutely extraordinarily fascinating, and I've found the implications of his 27-page bookkeeping treatise, which, you know, gave birth to this whole modern economy that we live in one way, arguably, although obviously there are people who disagree with me. Extraordinary. You know, I just found that fascinating. And I suppose I also like the combination of Renaissance and numbers because they're two of my favourite things. As for what I'll do next, I'm already sort of locked in to my next thing, which is a PhD in creative writing, which will probably cause as much controversy as my arguments tonight. So that's what I'm doing. I'm theoretically halfway through my PhD in creative writing.
Thank you. That was a wonderful and nice and important, but also a lot of fun. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Double Entry outside, and I'm sure our author would be happy to sign them. I'd be very brief. I mean, I found tonight both highly interesting and very challenging. I propose to head off and have a bob each way and then buy a hamburger on the way home along with a copy of the book. Raj Patel has priced a hamburger at $200 per hamburger, but down the road you can get it for $2.40 down at the quay. The real cost of this, according to Raj Patel, is $2,400. If you look at the trees and the petrol to get it here and the salaries of the people at Elton and Unwood, but for tonight, for $25, so I'd go and get one of them. Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.